Dr. Mark Rothman, incredible man. He works with disaster management and geriatrics with people with dementia, Alzheimer's. 9/11, he was there that day. He came out of the subway from Brooklyn right into Manhattan when the tower was struck. How he worked with disaster management to help in that situation, to Katrina, to floods in Houston. Was trained by Navy SEALs afterwards. He was at NYU Medical School at that time in NYC. Also how he works with dementia and patients with dementia and Alzheimer's. And he's got this great organization you're going to learn about called DementiaSpring.org, where he wants artists in the visual audio arts to contribute, and he's got funding for it. You can donate to it if you want as well to help people with dementia. Just a great story, a fascinating, inspiring man, Dr. Mark Rothman. I think you'll like this interview. I really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Joey Pins. People ask me, how did I lose 130 pounds? The quick answer is always discipline. I started my business, wasn't paying attention to my health, was eating too much, drinking too much sweets. My daughter was born. Next thing I know, I'm pre-diabetic, I have hypertension. I knew something had to change. Discipline. I, like many of you, have faced many challenges in your career, in your family, in your life, in your faith. How did you attack them? How did you approach them? How did you solve them, hopefully? It all had to have some degree of discipline. I'm also asked, how did you found and start a tech business that lasted over 25 years? Discipline. I was committed to it, enjoyed technology, didn't enjoy some aspects of it, but knew it was necessary. Discipline. Our podcast mission, how do we use discipline to better ourselves and society? Join me, please, as I talk to interesting people and discuss how they use discipline in their family, in their passion, in their careers, and how it helped them. Our podcast vision, growth through learning from others. Joey Pins Discipline Conversations. It'll be light and serious. Join us, please. Thank you for consideration. Dr. Mark, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for doing this.
It is my pleasure, Joe, to be here with you. Thanks for having me on and look forward to our conversation. I want to just make sure you know I have a hard stop at 6:40. So
no problem. Okay, I'll keep an eye on it. Dr. Mark Rothman, I mean, such an interesting what you do. Let's start with, I didn't even know there was something called disaster management. And what happens, I read 9/11 is kind of where it started, or where you did a lot of work there. Can you talk about that?
I'd be happy to. You know, I was in Lower Manhattan on 9/11. If you want to hear the story.
Please.
So 9/11, it was a normal day. Woke up in downtown Brooklyn where I was living with my fiance. And we hopped on the train together like we always did. And we split up underneath Brooklyn with her headed up the west side of Manhattan and me headed up the east side of Manhattan. And I came out of the subway on Houston and First Avenue to hop on the bus, looked up, and everybody was staring into the sky at the Twin Towers with smoke coming out the side. And about 6 minutes later, some big explosion. I didn't know what that was. That was the second plane. Turns out my wife was actually passing underneath the towers on the A train at about that exact moment. And thank goodness the train kept going and she went uptown. And I immediately realized I needed at Bellevue Hospital right now. So I stopped watching the skyline like all the other New Yorkers, forgot about the bus, hopped on a cab, made it uptown to Bellevue, and then basically spent the next 13 to 15 hours with my colleagues preparing the emergency room, getting ready for the sea of humans that we expected to come. And the short version of the story is that nobody came because almost everybody had died. Some of the Lower Manhattan hospitals got hit, St. Vincent's and others. We had a few people come in, not that many. I distinctly remember, I think it was a fireman he came in on a stretcher covered in soot, and he just kept saying, "They're down, man. They're down. They're down." And we just, it was hard to imagine it because we were locked inside our little emergency room bubble, you know, in scrubs, taking out equipment everywhere. And obviously, you know, that was a traumatic time in the city. I was in my fourth year of medical school. I then volunteered at the coroner's office because the coroner's office was situated inside NYU where I went to medical school. And I essentially volunteered for duty in what was the largest mass triage sorting exercise of human and construction remains in history. It literally took months, if not years, to sort through all of the rubble. They had tents and examination tables stretched all the way out into the street, essentially. They shut down 30th, and we would volunteer for shifts, and we would open up bags, body bags of rubble. We would find pieces of remains. I remember distinctly some of the full or almost full human torsos and bodies in their fire department uniforms with their name tags. And I visit that family's plaque at 9/11 each time I go there and pay respects to the one or two brothers who I remember digging out from those remains. And I realized throughout that whole exercise, which lasted a very, very long time, that I didn't have formal training in this situation. And you need people with formal training in these situations to anticipate, respond, and deal with these things if, God forbid, they ever happen again. You know, long story short, right, they continue to happen. And so I decided as a fourth year medical student to get trained in mass casualty incident command, disaster mitigation management response, went down to DC, got trained by these Navy SEAL fellows who understood mass casualty incidents and had been training the government. There was a huge uptick in training across all government agencies, hospitals, schools, local jurisdictions on mass casualty incident command and disaster response. I developed training programs at Yale for geriatric emergency preparedness and response, nursing home emergency preparedness, did some training out in Nevada to some of the state agencies. And lo and behold, all that training came in handy years later when Katrina hit and I was at Kindred Healthcare trying to supervise response to Katrina, huge hurricanes and flooding in Florida and Houston. I remember the Houston flooding situation. I mean, we literally had Humvees or Humvee-like, you know, vehicles trying to move medical supplies through flooded streets and counties into hospitals and procure equipment. And then coronavirus hit. And I immediately had to spring into command of the organization I was running, you know, just sort of organize the way things get done. Because in those situations, it's just chaos. And so people who know how to respond, how to organize response is really useful, very helpful. It puts a lot of people at ease, lets them be rest assured that things are happening, communication is flowing, and they can go about their business, which is obviously trying to help people. And so somehow or another, I find myself a physician trained in disaster management and mass casualty incidents. And it's come in handy, and it's been very helpful to the people that I serve in the workplace. So yeah, that's my story. That's sort of how it all happened. It just happened on a morning in September in Lower Manhattan, and it's been useful for decades.
They will never forget. Yeah. So when you were going through and finding rubble and finding remains, what was your exact mission there? To identify who was missing?
Yeah, we were essentially sorting and looking for identifiable body parts so that people could get DNA tested. And I think there was also an effort to put aside mementos and tokens and things that might identify somebody, but it was a lot of rubble. I mean, it was just, you just open a bag and there would just be dirt and cement and rebar and paper and all kinds of stuff. And you'd really be searching for human remains. And the thing that was interesting to me that stimulated me to get training, I think, was that who's going to do that work? And I would be talking to people, think of it as an assembly line. There were people to my left, my right, across the table as the bags were unloaded, and we just took them and, you know, did our part and passed them on. And they had come from all over the country. Fascinating group of people. I would say to, you know, I'm confused. Who, you know, who are you? You know, you don't go to medical school here. You don't work upstairs. You're not a volunteer from Queens or the Bronx or New York. And they would say, well, this is what I do. There's a whole cadre of people. And you saw this in Katrina a lot. And you see this on the news a lot. They are ready to be deployed. They have their phones ready. And the call goes out by FEMA or disaster management organizations. And they literally, you know, they go towards the burning building as everyone else is fleeing. And so there were people from all over the country helping us look for human remains, emergency room people, nurses, technicians from Louisiana and from California. And I was just inspired by how they were donating their time essentially to help us recover from the disaster. So yeah, it was a morbid business. It felt like an honorable thing to be doing. And it exposed me to all these other people who really rush in as everyone else is rushing out.
That's incredible. It's comforting to know there's people like that, you know, that people will do that. And then you said you were trained by Navy SEALs to help.
Yeah. So when I would go to these, I'd sign up for these seminars, like 2 days, 4 day intensive seminars on mass casualty incident command. And everybody was like, they were all Navy SEALs.
Wow.
I mean, they were all really amazingly cool. I mean, they were all dressed in dress shirts, you know, they didn't have their gear on, but they had been in Iraq. Well, I guess we hadn't been in Iraq yet. They had been in Korea, and they had been in Vietnam. They had served overseas. They'd been in Kosovo. I mean, they were just these amazing veterans who trained us, and we'd sit there in a conference room and they would drill us on how to set up incident command. So it was wonderful to get to meet folks like that as well.
I've had the fortune of meeting one Navy SEAL, gentleman. They're just a different cut of person. Just very, you know, we talked about these people who want to help people, but you know, their training and, you know, just the way they think is they just seem to be wired very differently, but very inspirational.
Yeah.
So then we take it with Katrina and how horrible that was. And I remember the floods in Houston. I'm in the technology industry and people had to get rowboats to get around. It was horrible. Yeah. And then of course we come to the pandemic now, which is, you know, where it is and where we think we are and how are your services used there?
Well, it's, you know, we're now, what are we now? 16 to 18 months in.
That's about right.
Goodness gracious.
Yes.
It's been quite a road. It's not over. Folks are done with the pandemic. Gosh, they want the pandemic to be over. I always tell folks, we want it to be over. We're done with the pandemic, but coronavirus is not quite done with us yet.
Yeah.
You know, we're a lovely host. It loves to move around amongst us. You know, we're like dogs. Dogs with fleas. You know, it's the flea. It loves us. Hitches a ride across town, happy as a clam. It's been tough. I've been very inspired by what I've seen in healthcare. You know, I remember the day that we realized we were going to have to shut it down. I was in an organization that went into people's living rooms to deliver care. Nurse practitioners and physicians going one house at a time. And I had patients out in Eastern Tennessee and Central Tennessee. I was working out of Nashville. You know, we were not going to be able to go into people's living rooms. It was just too unsafe. So we had to shut it down. We had to pull together the nurse practitioner workforce. And these are practitioners who, you know, they just have the patients in their hearts all day long. They are literally driving around windshield time galore, trying not to crash their cars while they check the map on their cell phone and field calls from the daughter and the son who wondering where they are. And they go sit with people who are struggling, you know, with chronic disease, end of life type diseases, terminal cancer. And people have gotten released from the hospital recently and can't get good services. We would be in areas where there's no cell phone coverage. You know, so these are just really, you know, these are people doing yeoman's work in the community, and we had to pull them out. You know, we said, we have to make you safe to go back in. And so we literally cut the cord, pulled everybody back. And I remember being on the phone, our first sort of webinar back when back when not everybody was as good with conference calls and Zoom, webinar, GoToMeeting, list your platform.
Yes.
And we had about 350, mostly nurse practitioners from around the nation on a telephone call, and they were scared. I mean, they were legitimately scared. And they, a lot of them had not put on PPE in years. Many of them had not been in a hospital intensive care unit for a couple of years. And it was really all about trying to get them to just get back to their training, stay professional, be thorough, and do what you need to do to keep the patient safe from a protection standpoint. And we got back into the homes within 6 or 7 weeks. I mean, we rejiggered all of our electronic medical record software programs. We procured PPE, sometimes at triple the price. We got it out to everybody. We had people literally watching others put on PPE in their kitchens, you know, giving them feedback, you know, don't forget, put this on first, put that on second. Don't forget to put this on last. And we got people back out into people's living rooms. And when we made it back into people's living rooms, some of those people had not had any medical care for a month and a half or 8 or 9 weeks. And these are people who are all over 65, terminal illness. They're probably at a doctor's appointment once a week, right? And they're on the phone with
them. Wow.
And so it was, the first few months were very intense. My calendar, for those who like calendars and Outlook like I do, I always joke, from 7 a.m. to like 9:30, 10:30 p.m., every half hour just said COVID, 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 COVID. I didn't know what the next meeting was. It was all about COVID. And that was just all day long, every day, standing up, response, educating the patients, educating our workforce. And that went on for months. And then I switched organizations and ended up running disaster management response to get my current organization also back into homes safely, effectively, communicate with all our clients. You know, the healthcare workers, they're unbelievable. I mean, look at what they're doing now. You know, they are back in it again and again and again and again. And my heart goes out to them, my respect and admiration for them. I'm one of them. I haven't had to spend my time in the intensive care unit. Although I would tell people at the very beginning of this disaster, you know, as they were scared and worried about their families, and I would say to them, remember, people, we're all part of this healthcare response infrastructure of this nation. And if 50 people from the intensive care units in my hometown fall ill and can't go to work, they're going to put out the call. And we have to be ready to go to our local hospitals. I know some of you haven't been in the intensive care unit for 4 years. I haven't been in an intensive care unit in 6. Like, you know, you have to be ready. You have to have trained. You have to have drilled. You have to know how to be safe and keep your patients safe, because you don't know when the call is going to come. And I think people felt comforted by that, right? You know, this notion that we're not in it alone. And the healthcare providers of this country have proven that they are in it together time and time again, now going on 16 plus 18 months. So it's been a real shock to the system, I think, for healthcare practitioners. I do hear a lot of them wanting out, you know, for better or for worse.
Burnout?
Yeah, you know, they just want out. They need a break. You know, whatever that means for them individually, for some of them, that just means they just need to do something else for, you know, 6 to 9 months until they get the itch, go back to the hospital. a lot of us, you know, most people in healthcare love taking care of patients and don't ever want to stop doing that. But it is hard to put on an entire space suit of PPE every day for as long as it's gone on. And it's going to continue. I mean, you know, pandemics have never lasted only a year and a half in history. They are 2 to 3 year events. I think this one will be no different. So I always tell people, try to gird yourself for that a little bit and go read an article about 1918. And you'll see that, you know, 2 to 4 years, that's about what's in store. So brace yourselves a little, take a deep breath, take care of your sort of mindset, however you do, whenever you get a break or out of work or whatever you need to do to recharge. But for the healthcare team of America, this is the long haul.
So did the healthcare workers in the beginning, were they fearful because there was so much uncertainty, or were they fearful that they were going to catch it and die, or catch it and pass on? Or was it a combination of both? Now that we're 16, 18 months mm-hmm. later, we know a lot more about it, and there's a, should be a little bit more level of comfort. What mm-hmm. was the fear of the healthcare workers?
I think the fear for my teams were that they were out in the community. They didn't have a closet full of protective equipment like you did in the hospital. And if you remember, like, you couldn't get PPE, right? You know, their friends in the hospital had signs that said, you know, give us PPE. You know, why have you not procured, why has the country not procured this? Why is it not being distributed? What's the delay? And so my teams, they were one step removed from that. And so, you know, there's no PPE around. And, you know, I haven't been in a hospital or put on PPE in an ICU, like I said, in, you know, three or four or 5 years. And I also think, and this comes around, and again, many times over the course of the 2 years, it's coming around now with the schools, you know, everyone also has real life, right? They have kids, right. Schools are getting shut down. Nobody's got enough daycare. You know, what if one person falls in? You also have to remember that, especially in healthcare and especially nurses, it is not uncommon for nurses to be the caregivers, not only to their patients, but also to their sick relatives. They often are supporting parents who are fallen ill and are often the major breadwinner of the family, and often are single, and often are women. So, you know, I really had to speak to that workforce, you know, and know that they were supported and could support each other. I think that's what the fear was about, right? How do I keep working, taking care of my patients and my children and my loved ones, and, you know, and earn a living, right? I mean, I don't think anybody was really thinking about that. Like, we were all in healthcare and didn't seem, you know, but when you go from making 7 to 10 visits a day to making none, you know, presumably you're still going to get paid, you know? And so there's just so much reassurance around what is the plan. It was palpable. I was scared too. I mean, everybody was scared. Right. So
much uncertainty, especially with those patients that are over 65, they're highly susceptible to COVID-19. And, you know, if we talk about COVID-19, I feel we just need to also talk about, you know, the three pillars of health, doctor, you know, diet, exercise, and sleep. And I think there could have been so much, such better outcomes with a lot of patients if a lot adhered to those kind of pillars of health.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how much it relates directly to the pandemic. The pandemic has messed up a lot of people's sleep. It's created incredible anxiety, you know, in society and, you know, among children especially. That's all in the news these days. There seems like there's lots of people, you know, doing lots of exercise during the pandemic. But the reality is that's not the vast majority, right? You know, the pandemic has really locked people indoors and been hard to deal with. And people are struggling sort of with how to stay active, how to stay engaged, how to stay interested in things. So it is tough. And I have a lot of friends who sort of, they tried making bread. They tried cooking for a little while. They didn't like it. My wife and I joke, if you're somebody who hated cooking before, it's not likely the pandemic turned you into Mario Batali,
Wolfgang Puck,
pick your Rachel Ray, like pick your food channel person. It's unlikely. Maybe it turns you into a baker for a little while. So it's hard. It's hard. It threw people's diet out the window. It threw people's exercise regimens a little bit out the window, but many people recovered from that. And sleep and anxiety wise, it's been a doozy. No question about that.
It certainly has. And I think today we've got some great news where it looks like the FDA has passed or approved the Pfizer vaccine. Any comment you want to make on that? I know it's a highly divisive topic, unfortunately, here in the US.
I guess so. It's not a divisive topic in my house.
Good. Mine either. I got it a long time ago. I got it when it was available. Absolutely.
You know, I'm triple vaccinated. My third dose yesterday. I was vaccinated very early January, like many healthcare workers in January.
Sure.
The common wisdom for those who study these things and know a lot about them and trust the science, which I do. So these vaccines are incredibly safe, incredibly effective. They're American made, by the way. They're free. No copay. That's solid. I look at it like this. This might veer out of the science a little bit for a second, but, you know, as sort of an American, a patriotic American, you know, the virus is the enemy, and the virus attacked us and has killed scores of Americans and left a lot of damage in its wake. And we played defense for basically almost a year. And public health measures are great. You know, social distancing worked. We created little bubbles around ourselves. We masked up. We washed our hands. And we bent that curve down, which was good, you know. But that's all defense. That's all defense, right? That's not offense. If you want to fight a war against an enemy, you need weapons, and you need to fire those weapons, and you need to be on offense. And that's how I view the vaccines, right? The vaccines are essentially a targeted missile at the heart of the virus, because we learned about the virus. We're much smarter than the virus. We're outnumbered. The virus is very opportunistic, like a flea, like I said, but we're smarter. We know the enemy's weakness. We targeted that weakness, and we developed weaponry. And if you view this as a war against an enemy, a scourge that has attacked our people and our loved ones and our society, my feeling is pick up the weapon and use it. There you go. You know, fire your two bullets, fire your three bullets. And, it's a citizen army. Like we can't delegate this to the Marines, unfortunately. My feeling is, you know, pick up the weapon and fire it. One citizen at a time. 90 million people, that's 180 million bullets. Like, I would love to see those shots fired. And the vaccines, by the way, are really good. The other thing I'll say is, people always ask me, if you go home and you take chondroitin and you eat a multivitamin and you eat some herbal remedies, and even some of the medicines you take that have been FDA approved, that your doctors prescribed, these medicines are more effective than most of those.
Interesting.
So, you know, use the most effective ones, right? But you should still take the multivitamin. It's still a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That might be a little controversial, but what can you tell? What can you do?
I guess some of the skepticism is also the RNA versus, you know, injecting it directly, and having your body. And so RNA is a very newer technology.
Yeah.
Perhaps some resistance is there.
Yeah. I was actually very bearish on the RNA techniques. I assumed that the traditional ones, like the ones that most vaccines are based on historically,
right,
all the vaccines we all take as children, smallpox, polio, measles, even the flu vaccines, yeah. I was much more bullish on the traditional technologies, which were largely being used out in Europe, AstraZeneca, et cetera. Turns out I was proven wrong. The mRNA vaccines worked really well. They had been obviously undergoing research for a long time, and they had been used to some degree, the technology. So I was really impressed. I mean, to develop vaccines within 8 or 9 months really just speaks to American ingenuity, stick-to-itiveness, and the fact that we have technology and computing power in 2021 that we just didn't have 50 years ago. So it's pretty darn impressive, I think.
Yeah, the discipline used by those companies to do that and to focus and pull everything away. Totally. And granted, they did make money on it, but they realized they had something very important to do. And we had three within, I don't know, months of each other?
Yes, yes. An unprecedented amount of money was thrown at the problem. Every scientist in America was essentially trained on that problem. So it's really amazing. And many people obviously get concerned. They say this is new and blah, blah. And I always say this, you literally had the clinical trial unfold in hundreds of millions of people in front of you in real time. They're safe. Right. They're safe. You've never had that before in your life, right? I mean, you take medications. They were done in clinical trials quietly over a long period of time. You could read the paper, I guess, but this was literally being tested in your community in live time. It's just fantastic.
Right. Incredible. So from disaster management to dementia. Dementia is the other area of your study, of your focus, of your practice. What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
So it's a great question. Lots of people ask that question. Dementia is actually one of the reasons I really became a geriatrician. It was dementia as a disease that piqued my imagination and really spoke to my heart when I first was enrolling in medical school. And learning about all the different diseases. You know, some people, get to medical school and they say, oh my gosh, like I want to, use this device on people who are suffering from this, or I want to take pictures of people and see their organs on the inside. And some people want to, take care of kids. And dementia just spoke to me. It's a disease that affects the brain. I've always been interested in neuroscience and the brain. And it speaks to the human in a very personal way that I kind of like, as someone who likes to hear people's stories, likes to understand, how they overcome disease and deal with disease. It has very poor treatments. It's got, there's all this great medicine that's been developed over the last 25, 35 years for things like heart disease. Look at cancer. There's so many cancers you can live with now for over 10, 20 years or cure. Think about, dialysis. You can live without kidneys for a really long time. Just a lot of diseases that can be managed now. And Alzheimer's disease, there's really not a lot of good therapeutics. We could talk about the one that was just approved. Back to vaccines for a second. If you want an effective drug, get the vaccine. The one for Alzheimer's is not that effective.
It's highly controversial.
Comparatively speaking, it's like... So dementia just really spoke to me in a personal way, and I've had family members and loved ones who have suffered from the disease, and so I embarked on a journey to learn more about the disease, to engage with people and their families who are dealing with dementia, and did research on dementia to some degree, and then have started to get involved with the dementia community through our foundation, where we're tackling a different aspect of it. We're tackling the question of how do you cope, right? What's out there in the community that you can that can help you cope with dementia and your loved one in the absence of a magic bullet, in the absence of a magic pill that cures all. So back to your question, the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia. So simplest way, Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. Dementias are diseases that affect one's ability to think and reason and then function, and there's multiple types, and Alzheimer's is by far the most common, right? The one that people know the name the best, and has probably the best track record of research because it was identified back in 1906 by Dr. Alzheimer. But there are other types of dementias, and they have different symptoms and they have different time courses. Some of them are much deadlier, quicker than Alzheimer's. And we're really trying to figure out which modalities, which potential therapies go to which ones. It's hard to identify them with complete certainty up front sometimes. Sometimes you're just at the beginning, you have people having problems, memory trouble, functional trouble. You've got to try to pick apart, is this Alzheimer's classic? Is this Lewy body? Is it related to another disease entirely, like a stroke? Or is it another kind of disease called late, which was discovered on sort of more on the brain pathology piece? So really just trying to sort that out. And a lot of physicians specialize in that now. Neurologists are better now at sorting out which dementia type it is. Geriatricians like me obviously spent a lot of time doing that in our careers. And internists are getting better trying to sort that out. But it's hard. It's not easy to sort out. People come in, they know they have memory trouble. They know that something's not right in the brain. They often have functional trouble. and they just want answers. And it's a hard disease. It's not like you can just sort of do a little biopsy and, you know, here's your disease. Here's the type, here's the treatment, unfortunately.
Are we learning that it is, I thought I was reading that the genes are passed on. You can have dementia genes from your parents. Is that correct?
In a very small percentage of people, you can really trace the actual genes right through. It's a very, very tiny percentage. And it's usually the kind that comes on much earlier than we're used to. Typical dementia, typical Alzheimer's disease, you would usually see it mid-70s. That's sort of typical, anywhere from early to late 70s. The early types of dementia that are passed down genetically by family very clearly often come on in the 50s. And for those of your listeners who have seen that, it's very painful to essentially have a disease that you're not supposed to get till you're 75, 80, 80 plus, and people in their 50s get it. So those are the ones that when we think of families that we follow with dementia genes, and they usually find their way to big medical centers where there's a center of excellence who studies those families. Yeah. So it can be passed down familially like that.
Yeah, my father was diagnosed about 10, 12 years ago, and then seemed like a very quick road. And since then, he's remarried. His wife kind of took him back to Italy to hopefully, have more care, more help there. But I mean, he's got no more language now. Yes. And it's a very, very dark road. I kind of said bye to him about 3 or 4 years ago, because I knew it wouldn't go well. So like you said, we'll talk about your foundation, but it's hardest on the families because as far as I could see, he's happy as anything, but he's just that, he's got no language. He can't help himself. And it's just a horrible, horrible disease.
It's well, thank you for sharing that with me and with your listeners, obviously. It is very difficult for families. And the truth is that most care for people with dementia is given not in nursing homes, although eventually people do often end up in a nursing home, not in hospice, although they do eventually end up in hospice for several months, perhaps at the end of life. Most care and most support is provided uncompensated, unpaid by family. And it places an incredible burden on those families. There's actually good research that shows a lot of spouses of people with dementia neglect their own health, right? They eventually can't make it to the cardiologist for their appointments. They miss appointments. They live at a heightened level of stress. Sort of like coronavirus pandemic, right? There was a commentary a year ago about how the coronavirus pandemic was making us all appreciate what it's like to be geriatric, really old, and or caregivers, because we're stuck at home and we're feeling sick and we're stressed out. That's kind of what being a caregiver for people with dementia can feel like. You feel like you're trapped in this bubble.
Yeah.
You're literally witnessing what's happening in front of you. The disease cuts at the person's very soul. It takes their thoughts, takes their speech, which you identified very well. It takes their sort of function, their ability to, get up, get dressed, walk around, get something out of the fridge, open the mail, like just function, things that we just take for granted. It takes that from them. And one of the hardest things I find, and perhaps you can relate to this, is it takes away the companionship.
Yeah.
My uncle, we call him a good close family friend. We call him my uncle. He cares for his wife. It's going on 15, 20 years of Alzheimer's. But one of the hardest parts that he shared with me was just that there's no banter.
Right.
Just the banter, the funny comment, the response to an observation, the poo-pooing of a crappy idea. Yeah. it just becomes very quiet, and that really is so hard on families. And there's no magic bullet for that. There's no pill for that. You know, part of what our foundation is about is trying to connect people with dementia and their caregivers with activities that bring sort of joy and that inspire a little bit of creativity. Because even with dementia, even though you can't necessarily express yourself, you know, verbally, right? Maybe can't formulate the sentence. Sentences are complicated. They often require 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, if you're like me in an interview with Joe, you know, 30 words in a row in the right order. It's complicated. But that doesn't mean that they can't participate in things, whether that's activities out and about the community. We work with artists and art therapists who do dance and song and art and music. And people with dementia can participate in that stuff. You know, they may not be able to talk about it, but they can participate. And when they do, it is just beautiful to see, because I'm sure you've experienced this. It feels like there they are again, right? You know, paying attention, engaged. And that's what we focus on. So yeah, it's so difficult. My heart goes out to all the caregivers, all the family members who are dealing with dementia in our communities, across the country, across the world, really, because it is a big problem globally.
It's horrible. You know, we Skype sometimes and there are just moments, maybe a second or so, where I see in his eyes, he recognizes me and his eyes kind of open and then it just kind of runs away.
Yes.
You know, and it's, it's horrible. So, okay, we need to talk about this drug. I think it's pronounced Aduhelm. Almost 20 years for them to release a drug. It did poor in the tests and the studies. It's almost $50,000.
Yeah.
People have resigned because the FDA passed it.
Yes. Prominent scientists, actually. People whose names I know and respect and have known for years since I was in training.
So why did it get passed?
I don't claim to know the inner workings of how these things function and work. People are actually diving in, I think, and doing a little investigating and trying to figure out, was there anything slightly unkosher around these relationships with this one company? The data was not very good. Unfortunately, the number needed to treat was very high to even see a response. The responses themselves were, you know, fair to middling at best. And so the committee, who spent all of this brain time and all using all of their scientific knowledge and resources and experience combing through reports and data readouts and study results, they said, well, if you're going to approve this thing, maybe, we don't recommend it, but if you're going to approve it, it's really just for a very small fraction of people who meet certain criteria that maybe in a few of these studies, you know, that group of people maybe had a little bit more of a response than everybody else. And yet the FDA went ahead and proved it for basically anybody with dementia.
Wow.
It was a little shocking to a lot of people in the community. Those folks resigned. They thought it was an abdication of the FDA's duty and responsibility. You know, you could interview them, call them and get their opinions about that. Mm. And the price tag is intense. What I tell people is, you know, hope is a very powerful thing. And people who deal with dementia, of all the types of patients that I have dealt with, perhaps similar to cancer patients, they're desperate for something to hope for and hold on to. I mean, there's not as much hope out there for the Alzheimer's community as for many other diseases, as I was saying, right? I mean, look at the HIV AIDS community, right? They galvanized, they got funding, they pulled together, they leveraged the science, and presto, HIV is a disease you can now live with.
Magic Johnson, huge star. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For decades. Yeah. You can live with it for decades. I mean, this is a success story. In my lifetime, you know, when I was a kid in high school, we were getting sex ed about not getting HIV. Totally. And it was deadly as can be. When I got to medical school, we were managing patients with HIV inpatient, but a lot of people were in the community with the early drugs. Flash forward 10, 15 years later, you know, I mean, you know,
it's gone.
you can treat it. It's still deadly. It still kills lots of people. But if you recognize it early, you have a plethora of drugs at your disposal, experts who can guide you through it, and you can live. Think about the hope that they witnessed. The dementia community has not had that degree of hope. And when you have not had that, and when you are looking and grasping for with desperately for hope, you know, there are people who have the resources who are going to pay and get this drug administered. There are people who might not have the resources, but they're going to leverage their family somehow. There are people who are going to take a second mortgage on their home. There are people, they're going to do whatever they need to do to try this medicine and hope that it provides something of a benefit, slows the progression, helps people keep their speech maybe longer, whatever it is, however you judge it. It's a powerful thing when you're dealing with such desperation in a community. So my heart really goes out to everybody who wanted it to work better than it does and who will try it. And I'm sure some will receive a benefit from it, right? I'm not telling people it doesn't work, but you'll be one of the lucky ones if you see a response and you feel like it's durable. A lot of people will not be so lucky, and the expense will be intense. That's where we are. It's a weird one. It's a weird controversial one that folks like me don't usually have to talk about.
Right. Yeah. And so we have Dementia Spring that you have, which is a foundation that helps the families with art, with dementia. I watch your videos. It's just an incredible, incredible idea. Talk to me about it.
Well, it was partially born out of my passion for people with dementia and their caregivers and the need to try to help them out in the community. It started out with just a few videos trying to help people understand what dementia was. I like to joke I was between jobs. And so I did what any self-respecting teenager would do. I started a YouTube channel. And my wife, who is a book restorer and an amateur photographer by training and worked in the Metropolitan Museum for many years when I met her and afterwards. And so we decided to try to bring together these two communities. And it kind of worked out with the pandemic because both of these communities have really suffered. So artists who essentially saw their livelihoods just disappear overnight, unable to perform, unable to show their work, unable to engage with their community, and people with dementia who basically got stuck at home, cut off from all the activities that they were doing beforehand, whether that was exercise groups, walking groups, dancing, singing, art therapy services, even just going to adult daycare and support groups. Everything went virtual. And for people with dementia, the virtual solution is not quite so good. For many reasons, it's not hard to imagine, right? And so we decided that for the artists who raise awareness about dementia and who inspire creativity in people living with dementia and their caregivers, we would try to bring them together through the Dementia Spring Foundation. And so we are supporting artists who do that work and arts organizations who do that work through grants that we'll be giving to try to kind of jumpstart them back in the post-pandemic era. It's a very exciting time for those two things to come together, because dementia is being shown and talked about in a way that it never was 10, 20, 30 years ago. If you think about it, look, the Academy Award went to Anthony Hopkins for playing a character with memory loss.
The movie scared me. That movie was incredible.
The truth is that people with dementia back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe even the 80s and 90s to some degree, were largely hidden by their families. Right.
Yeah.
If someone had memory loss, you hid them at home. You didn't talk about it very much, except with trusted people. You rarely brought them out into the community. And we need to bust open that box, right? That hiding people with dementia at home out of embarrassment or fear or protective urges, it's not the right thing for them. They need to be engaged. There are people in the community and organizations in the community that welcome them now. Same way we welcome people with disabilities, right? So museums have programs for people with memory loss. The opera, dance, music performances are very welcoming and we should be bringing our people with dementia to them and exposing them to these things where we can. And so that's what the Dementia Spring Foundation is all about.
So artists can come, and I see you're actually going to have awards.
We are looking for artists who raise awareness about dementia through their work, visual and performing artists, whether that's producers, documentarians, musicians, dancers, choreographers, sculptors, anything that's visual or performing. And we're going to accept applications from them to contribute to their projects and bring them to fruition, or arts organizations that really target people with dementia. And that's what their whole program is all about. They need support as well. They've largely gone virtual and really need to get back out into the community, and we want to support them too. So it's our first round of ever trying this. So if people are interested, they can check out dementiaspring.org. They can donate to us. It's tax deductible. We're a 501c3 if they're interested. We're going to be sponsoring some of the Alzheimer's walks this fall here in Louisville. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. We're part of the Give for Good Louisville campaign. We're certified as a 501c3. So anybody wants to support us or really just share the news with artists and arts organizations about the applications, we're hoping to wrap it up by the end of the month, mid-September, and then give the awards if we're live by then here with you on the broadcast.
DementiaSpring.org. I remember reading a study about how just music helps dementia, helps people with dementia. Sometimes it can actually recall things through music.
Yeah, there's if you've ever seen or heard of a program called Music and Memory, that was really the first product that got itself together, organized, and essentially used music. This is what people remember, and you can see this on YouTube if you search. Essentially, sort of woke people up. Wow. Who were nonverbal, very sedentary and still, obviously were a little bit, you know, checked out. And when you play the right music, the music that they deep inside the recesses of their brain already know, right? Playing Britney Spears for an 85-year-old person with dementia, it does not resonate. It's just noise. But playing, you know, Count Basie or
Duke Ellington or
jazz or singers from that era, Frank Sinatra or whoever it is, if it's the right match to what they know, or religious music or gospel, it can just trigger something. And there's all kinds of videos on YouTube that people love to watch. It's really amazing. You know, the truth is that the brain itself does hardwire things. And so even though someone is not verbal and can't respond necessarily to the cues that you want them to respond to in the time that you expect them to do so, because we put that on people with dementia a lot, right? We ask them a question, we want an answer.
Right.
Right. And we want it in a time period that makes sense to us. They may or may not be able to do that, but the hardwiring of remote memory, distant memory from their remote past is still in there. And if you can trigger it, the electric circuits fire. But you have to trigger it. You have to work a little bit to understand what the triggers can be. With my Aunt Sandy, it's song. So if I hum tunes, before you know it, she and I are humming tunes together. It might only last for 30 seconds, but I can come back to it again a minute or two later, and I can relish and enjoy with her those moments. They might not be connected the way that our moments are connected throughout this interview and throughout our discussions. That's a structure that we demand, that we are accustomed to, the need to connect all these moments. For people with very advanced dementia, they're not connected. And so you really have to sort of surrender to being with them in the moment, even if those moments are not connected, and revisit them. And so for her, it's music. For others, it's singing. There's a wonderful, wonderful documentary called The Dementia Choir about folks with more moderate memory loss, not quite as severe, in England, who got together and sang. And these were all people who had sung in their younger years, and it was amazing. the way that it sort of motivated them and inspired them and gave them energy, actually, to participate. And their caregivers talk about that. So using the arts to trigger what's inside is a really nice way to get around the problem of only using words and language. Because that's what most of us do, right? We ask questions. We want an answer. That's very verbal. And like I said, speech is complicated. So using art to trigger excitement, inspiration, enthusiasm, joy, whatever is inspired, is a really nice way. It's kind of sneaky. It's a nice way to go around that heavy dependence upon speech that people with dementia often can't, respond to well enough.
How much of what you do is science and how much is art?
With dementia?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go just with dementia.
With dementia, you got to have a healthy mix. Yeah. Ask any caregiver.
You've just described a lot of art that's kind of triggering science.
You got to, everything about dementia takes a little bit of art. Just the art of the possible. You ask any caregiver, how much is science? Just on the day-to-day, how you take care of somebody with dementia. Yeah. You know, getting them bathed, getting them fed, helping them get somewhere. How much of it is science and technique? And training, you know, not only by doctors, right? Physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, recreation therapists, nurses, you know, how much of it is science and training, and how much of it is a pretty healthy dose of improvisation and a little artistry. And they will tell you, they weave in the art of the possible all day long, every day. So it's a mixture. That's part of why I like dementia. I think it's not as cut and dry as a lot of diseases where there's the diagnosis, there's the treatment, take the pills home, take them, you know, see you back in 6 weeks. With dementia, you got to mix a little bit of the art with the science and most importantly, the personal, the human, which I like.
I remember as a child, my father's an Italian immigrant, but for some reason he would always sing My Girl. Not always, but often. And when he started in this journey, I tried to sing it, you know, I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. And I would just kind of look at him and it wouldn't happen. But, you know, I tried it a few times and every once in a while, I kind of get a turn of the head. And I just, you know, I wonder if that's, you know, if that's a trigger. It's just an amazing and terrible. I remember when Ronald Reagan was diagnosed with it and he wrote a letter saying, I'm going down a road now and I'm not going to be myself. I'm writing this letter as I have my full faculties. And this was back in the 80s, you know, and, his wife and other caregivers had to take care of him. And, but what you're doing with Dementia Spring. So again, if people want to get in, go to dementiaspring.org. And they can donate, they can submit, you want things in the visual arts, visual and audio arts. And how else can people, I really appreciate your time today. Fascinating. From 9/11 to dementia. I mean, you're doing great things, doctor. I don't know if you get to hear this enough. You mentioned that there's people that come there at 9/11 and help, but you're doing great things and you need to hear that more. Needs to be more people like yourself. So how can people get in touch with you? Dementiaspring.org. How else?
You can find us on social media. We're out there. I'm sure Mark Rothman, MD, is easily findable on Google. Visit us on the website. You can send us a note, an email, contact us. That's the easiest way to find us, I think. Thanks for your kind words. Means a lot. Appreciate it.
You're inspiring. Thank you so much for your time today. I love the conversation and maybe someday we'll get to sit down face to face and continue the conversation. Hopefully more drugs will be introduced that have better results and that can carry us further with this.
Without a doubt. Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You be well. Thank you for listening and or viewing Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations. Please share this episode with one or two of your friends who you think may benefit from the episode. Our website, www.joeypinns.com. there you'll find lots of resources, and you could join our mailing list. Please follow us on all our social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Podcast information, the video version of our podcast is on YouTube. Please subscribe. Audio is on all major podcasting platforms. Please follow them. And if you like it, please consider giving 5-star rating. Would really appreciate that. Would you like to financially support the podcast? You can go to our Patreon site. Consider $5, $10, or $20 a month. There's all kind of plans that we have there. There's like a one-time payment. What is this podcast episode worth to you? $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000. You be the judge. You can go to our PayPal account to do that as well. Thank you again for listening or watching Joey Pinn's Disciplined Conversation.